Howdy, Brendan.
Howdy, Alan.
The Not a Thing podcast is up and running for episode 203. We have a Western-themed end of episode coming soon. But before we get there, we have lots of things to talk about. And when I say lots of things, I mean lots of things. Lots of, like, things. Things that we want, not things, which we sometimes lead off the show with in order to have a good feeling about ourselves as we end the show. but it's great. We have a lot to talk about this week, and thanks for tuning in, everyone that's tuned in, and everyone that has tuned in kind of recently. Welcome to the Not a Thing podcast. It's a fun time. We're in the 200s and free and clear. Well, not that free. I mean, we're still paying for the hosting fees ourselves. But if you would like to sponsor the show, let us know. We have no qualms about saying whatever things you want about the state of the world. Hashtag we don't do hashtag
flatter
anymore.
No.
Hashtag reptilian overlords. Yep. But
in any case, for the record, we have done over 200 of these. You know that people don't actually tune into this. Is not a radio program, Alan. This is a podcast.
You don't sit like with a dial.
Turn the knobs on your headphones.
I still kind of play with the knob. It doesn't exist anymore. It's really sad. I still remember when iPods had a wheel on them, a physical wheel on them.
That is both new and old.
Yeah.
It's a modern anachronism.
That's technology that has come and gone since doing shows on radio. Yeah.
The knob business has really taken a turn since capacitive touchscreens became the rage.
Knobs, not a thing.
There's something satisfying about a knob. But touchscreens are also satisfying.
Yes.
Pretty much just doing things with your hands is satisfying. Okay, well, I'm going to stop myself there. Let's get to the topics.
Right, shall we? Let's start with a perennial favorite, which I think we should start renaming the different segments of the show that we don't really have segments for. I mean, sometimes we would have a segment on the show talking about police kind of overreaches, and we used to call it the fuck the police segment. And I think this actually belongs in the, like, unfuck the police kind of segment,
I would say maybe even we go with something like police accountability segment. Because it works for either way.
Yeah.
And that, I think, our whole point is accountability.
Yes.
It's better practices. It's not that all cops are bad. We don't hate cops.
We absolutely don't.
But they do need to be held to a certain standard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is not shooting innocent citizens. It's a really fucking low bar.
Yeah. And so California has made a big step in this. They've standardized across the state a use of force database that police will have to log any incidents in. No matter how small, no matter how big, and that will, and it's an open source database, and it's publicly available and transparent. So there's accountability, just like it exists. Ideally, as long as everyone is above board and filling in details and stuff like that. I believe the name of it is called Ursus, which is Latin for bear, because California's symbol, the golden bear, is that. I don't know what it stands for, but I can see how uniform something. I don't know. I didn't look at the.
It's like shield. Like they're making a stretch to make it work. I'm sure.
Okay. but yes, California is making a universal use of force database within the state. It's the kind of thing that we pulled up and we're like, you mean this doesn't exist already?
Yeah, I don't know how this didn't already exist.
Yeah.
And we're only the fourth state to start doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the FBI has just started doing it. But right. It's not compulsory for departments to report their actual numbers. So, way to go.
Little steps. We're almost there.
We're almost to the point of not sliding backwards. And actually, we're not making forward progress. But or into the positive. We're still just barely getting out of the red.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of red to get out. Congrats for California for pulling that together. Yay, my home state.
We'll see. Hopefully this will help.
Another small step can be taken, or maybe even big steps. Elon Musk at the modern day or current day Iron Man? I don't know.
Well, I'd say Tony Stark. I don't know about Iron Man.
Right. Not yet, anyway.
I mean, he wears the suit well, but it doesn't have missiles or lasers. It doesn't fly.
At a conference this week, he released a pretty big plan for going to Mars. We had talked about it on an insert episode here about potentially having the Red Dragon capsule. So this was taking the Dragon capsule, which is used to ferry stuff up to the International Space Station and things like that, to generally get stuff into space that they're currently using, but then retrofit it to go to Mars. And that's the kind of expected plan, that you would take an existing kind of smaller capsule and then essentially just put a bigger rocket underneath it to get it to Mars. Turns out he's one-upping that original kind of plan. Actually, more than one. It's like many, like an order of 100 more, because he wants to send not, you know, like 5 or 6 people in a very cramped thing to Mars. He wants to send like 100 people in a rocket to Mars. It's wild.
I know some people are going to start nominating. Like, you want, like, either it doesn't work and it blows up and those people are gone, or it works and they're on fucking Mars.
Don't
send the best and brightest.
No, it's definitely going to be a volunteer mission. I think the plan is to have a rocket that is many, many, many times bigger than the current Falcon 9 rockets, which have Merlin engines. So these are the Draco engines, which are like by weight something like 10 times more powerful. And then they're going to put like a lot of them in this rocket. The rocket is tentatively called the BFR, which I believe stands for Big Fucking Rocket.
Which is excellent.
It's like, oh, okay, all right, great job. Yeah. And then it's going to carry a payload of like I said, the crew craft, which is going to hold 100 people. And the way that they described it, it sounds like everyone's going to get their own like little dorm room in this spacecraft. They're going to have like a zero-G environment, because there's no it doesn't rotate for any kind of artificial gravity. So it's just this big like hangout play space for what sounds like it could be up to 80 days is the current guess for how long it would take to get to Mars. But they want to send a bunch of people to not and then the theory behind sending a lot of people is that you won't go kind of crazy just dealing with the same like 4 or 5 people in a small space, and you'll have that many more minds to throw at problems when they occur as you get to Mars.
And it would also reduce the cost per person, because they can spread it out over more people.
It's true. I think the cost per person was something like, it was over $1 million, or it currently is over $1 million to get anyone to and from the International Space Station. He wanted to get the price down under the U.S. median price for a home, which was $200,000, which seems like a deal. I don't know. I'm glad it's not the California price for homes, because that's ridiculous.
Like, oh, $200,000, that's a great deal.
Right. I should trade my house in. We could send everybody to Mars. But real audacious.
I realized that I just a few minutes ago suggested creating basically Australia in space, and I retract that suggestion. I don't want to make space Australia.
No, we don't want Total Recall on Mars is really what we don't want.
Or that's how you end up with, was it Ghosts of Mars with Ice Cube? Nobody wants that.
Nobody wants that. No. So we'll see. There's not a lot of timelines and things in the presentation he made about getting to Mars. All of the numbers sound really interesting and maybe even a little low. Like he was saying that he could potentially build the crew craft for, I think it was like $300 million, which is like the price of a Boeing, like a new plane, which I feel like is low, but I don't know. Maybe he has a lot of, you know, manufacturing hookups after working with
he's
everything.
He's got a lot
so
of
far.
Coupons. He's been clipping his coupons for years.
You know, 400,000 reservations for the Model 3, the Tesla Model 3, probably are going towards that. We'll see. I like the thought that I'm indirectly funding space travel. I want this. But we'll see. The really cool thing, if you watch the video of them, of the proposed kind of launch, and then, you know, all the things they could do when it lands on Mars and everyone kind of comes out of the capsule, they pull back and it's a shot of Mars kind of rotating, and then in the last, like, it goes for like 6 or 7 seconds, and in the last 2 seconds, the color of the planet turns kind of blue and green in addition to the red that is Mars. So I think he's throwing in a hint that they want to terraform Mars as well, which is like, oh, I love it. I want to see it. We'll see. Space, it's a thing. Hopefully.
This planet, yeah.
Kind of staying in space, NASA had a pretty big announcement this week. They were very quick to follow up their teaser for the announcement with, spoiler alert, it's not aliens, which I think was classy of them. But
they
did announce that two different telescope facilities, including the Hubble, have seen what appear to be jets of liquid coming from Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter. They've always had a good kind of guess that there was a large ice sheet around Europa, and that potentially there could be liquid, maybe even water, underneath that ice. And the fact that they can see kind of plumes ejecting from the surface is a good indicator that you know, might be true. And ideally, if it's liquid as it goes up, it might be liquid if it comes back down, and they could analyze things in the liquid and stuff like that. So that may be kind of fuel for getting some folks out there. Europa, if you're a Arthur C. Clarke fan, was the where the aliens were from 2001. I don't know. We'll see. I'm a big fan of that series of books, so the nerd in me is even more happy than usual about hearing about stuff in space. This week has been, you know, kind of big for space news. There was also there was a very brief note that Jeff Bezos's their Blue Origin thing, they're going to test the space escape, essentially the ejector seat that they're going to put in into their rockets. So they're going to have a rocket launch fail on purpose so they can see if the crew ejection method works, which is important. You should test that too. But that's happening next week, so we'll see how that goes. Staying in this week, we have news that we can all raise a glass to. In Bruges, they've completed work on the first beer pipeline. Bruges has one of the oldest breweries in existence. It's something, I want to say it's from the 1500s, and it's in the city center. And so they can only do so much in the city center. They can't really modify the buildings that much because they are, you know, very, very old. It is a, you know, kind of medieval era city. So the brewery that's there brews the beer, and they currently take all of the beer in tanker trucks to the bottling facility, which is on the outskirts of town. And then they have figured out that it would be more cost effective for them if they had a brewery pipeline between the brewery and the bottling plant, so they could keep the facilities where they are and then potentially expand the bottling plant as they grow. But the brewery itself, you know, can only expand so much more, and rather than have take the brewing facility and then relocate it, which would probably make the beer taste different because it would whenever you change kind of major factors like that, they've decided to keep with the system they have. And having this is the first beer pipeline. I don't remember how far the pipeline goes, but
it's about 2 miles.
That's amazing, because I feel like the you know, whatever the distance is between the keg and the tap is already too much at the at the bar that I go to, because you always get so much foam, so much head off of the beer. But I believe because
it's, these are better tubes.
They're better tubes, and I believe because it's just brewed beer, it probably isn't carbonated yet when they send it. So it's possible that knowing enough about the beer making process, they probably don't do the carbonation on site. They probably do that at the bottling plant. So that's probably for the best. So you don't have crazy foamy beer just like blowing out, you know, pipelines among the city. But it sounds like they ran this as a partially crowdfunded affair, and one of the donation levels was a pint of beer for life, a pint of beer every day for life, which is awesome.
It only costs you like 7,500 euros.
Yeah. But I think it's really impressive, because not only are they getting their beer more efficiently from their brewery to the bottling plant, they're also not using any of those trucks to deliver that beer. So there's less congestion in the city, and there's a lot less carbon footprint just from bringing, you know, having these trucks that are only going, you know, the two or whatever miles it is between those two places. So,
and they can still fill 12,000 bottles an hour.
God,
for the amount of beer that they're sending through that pipe.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's
I already wanted to go to Bruges, because one of my favorite movies of all time is set in Bruges. Movie in Bruges. I already wanted to go there, and now I kind of feel like I have to go there.
Right. I had not heard of this beer. They characterize it as sort of a sour, which is in right now. I don't particularly like sour, so I would still like to try it, if only to say that I've had beer that traveled 2 miles in a pipeline. That's fantastic. Hopefully, there's more. There could be more pipelines like this, and less pipelines like the one that everyone is protesting, that is not in the news at all. Between the US and Canada about their tar sands. More beer pipelines, less oil pipelines.
Yes.
Kind of moving along from beer to something that might be in beer, or at least sort of is in beer, yeasts. And then yeasts are a single-celled organism, kind of like an amoeba. There we go. See? I did it. Amoeba Records, a music chain, music store chain in California, at least. Their Berkeley branch has just gotten their seller's permits and all of their ducks in a row to sell medical marijuana out of the record store in Berkeley. I think this makes a lot of sense for their purposes. I think it's funny that it's funny that it's in Berkeley, because there's so much of what I think of when I think kind of the push for making retail recreational but also medicinal marijuana in California has come out of kind of Oakland and Berkeley in the last few years. So it makes sense. Go Amoeba for pushing the envelope there.
Two stories in a row cutting out the middleman. Like, just put the beer in the pipe straight to the beer. Put the weed with the music. One-stop shop.
Yeah. They still have to deal with a bunch of things, even if California passes the, I think it's called the Adult Use of Marijuana Act this year in November. It's still kind of an issue federally. We've talked about that on the show many times, about it being a Schedule I narcotic, which means that it has, in the eyes of the federal government, no value other than addicting people. And so that means that you can't run things like tests or studies without a lot of hoops. And if we're calling it medicinal marijuana, I think dealing with it in a medicinal kind of way with regulations is probably important. Hopefully that's a thing sometime soon. In the meantime, put your headphones on, rock out.
Vote early, vote often.
Sticking in the kind of small things that you have to see with microscopes kind of flavor here, we're moving over to bacteria, and bacteria suck. They're becoming more and more resistant to antibiotics, of course, like penicillin and things like that. There are different motions and actions for that, like specific to different bacteria, and they all often have the problem, like I said, of the bacteria becoming resistant to them. They're essentially reproducing so often that they're evolving to fight the thing that's fighting them, even within like the number of generations that happen in the human body as those things reproduce is a lot higher than seeing like evolution of animals, just because there's so many more generations that can happen. And so resistances tend to go up. And so what tends to happen is the antibiotics either we have to figure out new mechanisms for them, or essentially increase the dosage, which makes it more dangerous for the other things in the body that that get hit with the antibiotics. So a lot more danger for side effects and things like that. So some innovative kid, I say kid very loosely, they're 25 years old, but let's be clear, kids, figured out.
He's a student.
She figured out a polymer. It's a kind of peptide chain that you can release into a system. And what it does is, and I don't know exactly how it does it. I didn't read that that deeply into the scholarly part of the article, but it essentially has it's of a certain particle size that's big enough that it won't kind of bump into like regular cell walls and do anything. But if it bumps into the cell wall of a bacterium, it will poke it and poke holes in it, and eventually
shred it enough that the bacteria just falls apart on its own. I don't know how it knows to not kind of poke other things. I don't know if there's any side effects that that come from this. They, I'm sure, are doing lots of studies to figure that out. But the interesting thing is, because it is, it's, you know, attacking the cell walls directly of the bacteria, it's not very likely that things can come, the bacteria can become resistant to it. Or at least that's the theory, is that it's not acting in a traditional antibiotic kind of way. And so the bacteria would have to go undergo a lot more changes to be resistant to this thing, which goes through and essentially just like shoots holes in it. It just sounds cool. They have a picture in the article, and we'll link it, of the wall of the bacteria that essentially perforated after, you know, running across this polymer. It just sounds like, you know, it's you know, some kind of crazy like hitman bacteria that goes in and just like stabs the bacteria. Like,
well, just looking at the picture of it from the microscope, it looks like that bacteria got headshotted.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is interesting, and being allergic to two kinds of antibiotics, I would be happy to know what what comes of this, if we can use a non-antibiotic method for killing bacteria. Let's go. Let's do it. moving. Let's see. Where are we? Here we. I lost where we are. There we are.
We're going swimming with the dolphins.
I can't speak, but apparently dolphins can. So maybe we should have a dolphin podcast. That should be a thing.
That would be so annoying.
Researchers in Russia who've they have access to some dolphins that are still in captivity there. They've been recording the sounds that dolphins make, ideally to find if there are any patterns or any things that they can tease out of what dolphins, what the sounds that they make. And they have put together that they that dolphins can speak to each other and do speak to each other in sentences. They've figured out that the noises that they make aren't random, and that they appear to make them in bursts. And they take turns speaking, like they're conversing, like one talks and the other talks and one talks and the other talks. And they're kind of guessing that the sentences are approximately 5 words long. I don't know how they come up with that metric.
Up to 5 words. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how they come up with that metric. If they've been able to identify like specific sounds or anything, they have to clearly run all of the sounds that they make into some kind of large big data translation machine, kind of like the one that I think Google just announced their machine learning algorithm for translation is like on par with a native speaker now, at least in a written form. I would love for them to throw the data at the dolphin speak to see what they're saying. And hopefully they're not saying, fuck you all, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, stupid, stupid people.
I can almost guarantee that that's what the dolphins in Japan are saying.
Oh, ah.
Japan, you're fucking up with the dolphins.
Yeah, yeah. Dolphins, Douglas Adams surmised, would be the ones to leave the planet first once they figured out it was doomed. So we'll see how that goes. I know you know, there have been a lot of studies about dolphins and their propensity for intelligence. Their brains are actually bigger than humans, so it's pretty good guess that they are actually talking. We just want to know what they're saying, and maybe we can say stuff to them. That would be pretty crazy and fantastic.
Sorry, we murdered all your friends and ate you when there were other food sources that weren't intelligent.
Yeah. We have a lot of, there are going to be a lot of words.
If you're looking for a cheer me up kind of thing, go ahead and watch The Cove again. And if you haven't seen it, go ahead and watch it, and I apologize in advance.
So as you can guess, we're entering spoiler territory now, now that we're giving documentary recommendations. But we're not talking about a documentary this week. We're going to talk about Westerns. Like I said at the beginning of the show, we both saw Westerns in the last kind of week or so, and we're going to start with Hell or High Water, which is maybe my favorite movie this year. Maybe.
It's the other guy still, I think, was better.
Was that this year?
That was this year.
I feel like that was just before the beginning of this year, but okay. No, The Other Guys is still there.
But no, it's really good. I very much enjoyed it. It was a beautiful movie. It was well shot. The acting was great. You had Jeff Bridges and Chris Pine and Ben Foster.
Yep.
It was
that lady at the T-Bone Diner.
Oh yeah, she was great.
What don't you want? Yeah. It was really intense for a movie that is a heist film, essentially. It didn't lean on the action accelerator as much as it probably could have. It left a lot of the action in very short bursts, but so much room to breathe with shots of land, the land and driving. It a lot of memories of the first season of True Detective when they're just kind of in the car and talking. You know, from a lot of angles, both the Ben Foster and Chris Pine characters, but then also Jeff Bridges and his partner, whose name I don't remember.
Gil Birmingham is the actor.
Okay, yeah. Just really good, you know, really good tension between things, but still enough room for there to be lightness. And I mean, a good portrayal of a relationship of two brothers, neither of which I want to be. I do have one brother. I hope neither my brother nor me turn into either of those two guys. But no, I liked it a lot. It's not in a lot of theaters. It may actually probably
it's already be gone.
May be gone by the time you hear this, but look for it. It has a soundtrack by Nick Cave, which is rad. Or not a soundtrack, rather score. There are a few songs in the soundtrack, including what I think is a speed metal song, but just for one scene. But the score kind of matches the movie really well. There's a lot of it's just really well shot and well paced, and nice to watch. So. Big
it's very
up.
Lean. It's really lean.
Yeah.
Like everything felt like it needed to be there and it didn't waste time. Well, it wasted a lot of time, but in a good way.
Yeah.
Like it didn't feel like time wasted. It felt like it was intentional.
Right. Right. So I said we saw two Westerns, and so that was one of them. It's a modern Western. It's as Skylar pointed out, there is a horse. So it's a Western. But we both also saw The Magnificent Seven this week. I saw it on opening day, actually, the 23rd. And then you just saw it last night?
Yeah, I saw it last night.
Yeah. It is a remake. As if you didn't know, it's a remake, and it's not only is it a remake of another movie, that movie, the original The Magnificent Seven, is kind of a westernized remake of an Akira Kurosawa film, The Seven Samurai. And so it's got kind of a copy of a copy kind of problem. And so my expectation coming in is just don't insult either of those two movies. And I think it succeeds doing that. It kind of stands alone as its own movie. It was just kind of fine.
It felt all very engineered. Like, we're going to make this to be a successful movie.
Yeah.
Not that we're passionate about it, but we've got Denzel Washington and Chris Pratt, and we've got Anton Fuqua, and we've got all these things. That, oh, we're going to have all these diverse characters that weren't in the original, and we're going to, everything's, this felt like, okay, we've checked all the boxes. Now let's go make some money.
Yeah. It did feel like good. I remember watching it and thinking like, this is good, but not like I'm drawn to it, not anything. And I think
it was a fine movie.
Yeah. I think that's that. Maybe I could give it a rewatch and it would be okay, but it doesn't have that feeling of like, oh, well, this is a classic and I'm going to put this right on the shelf next to, Magnificent Seven.
It holds up to the original. No, it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's,
you know what? You know what else? The bad guy is Peter Sarsgaard. You know, other movie had bad guys Peter Sarsgaard? Green Lantern. Stop casting Peter Sarsgaard as the bad guy.
At least they did a really good job of making the bad guy like 1,000% evil. There's no question that he might be not evil. And in the original Magnificent Seven, the guy who played the bad guy, there's at least some like lightness and jokiness when he appears and stuff. But there's none of that, which I think makes it kind of like, I don't know. It took me out of it a little bit because it's like you can give depth to your good guy characters, but not to your bad guy characters. I don't know. But I had only one like very, very bad, like, you should not have done this kind of moment. The rest of the movie is fine. In the very, very end of the film, and I'm not spoiling it, because it's, I think you can guess, there's a shot of the town as the camera pans through and it goes over grave markers and then kind of pans upward and then it's the credits. And that's fine. That's fine that they did that. But it's 100% CG. And I don't know why they felt the need to do that. Because the whole rest of the film, I mean, there's probably some CG work to make things happen. Like, you know, they're horses and they're explosions. They're clearly not horses next to explosions. I'm sure a lot of that was done in CG. But for whatever reason, they couldn't get a shot of a hill with grave markers on it and sunlight. They had to fake that. And it looks so tacked on compared to the rest of the film. Because there are a lot of beautiful shots of the horses running and there's like nothing around. They clearly went out to the middle of nowhere in order to shoot, you know, certain scenes in this film. But that shot looked really bad. And then they added a voiceover to it. And it's just, oh, this is a cheap, cheap movie all of a sudden.
They were magnificent. Go fuck yourself.
That's the only thing in the movie that was like, all right, this is terrible. And then, unfortunately, it was also the last thing in the movie, so that's the thing I remember most.
I mean, I think all the actors in it did a good job in their roles. Like, they made interesting characters.
Yeah.
For the most part. My biggest complaint is a complaint I have with a lot of movies that are scored by James Horner. James Horner is one of the most frustrating people to do music for movies for me. He's written some great scores. Like, mm-hmm. He did the score for The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
He did The Rocketeer. He's done a lot of amazing movies. He also is the laziest piece of shit when it comes to writing the music, because he uses the same refrains in all of his movies.
Yeah.
Like, the ones that are really good are the ones that are unique. The ones that, like, there's a refrain he used in, and I think I've even talked about this on the podcast before, because we've talked about other movies that have been scored by James Horner, where it's the same, the trumpet piece that they use in a bunch of his movies, like in Enemy at the Gates.
Mm-hmm.
It's the ba-da-ba-da, which they also used in Avatar,
yep.
Which they also used in, also used in, also used in all of his fucking movies. In this one, he went even next level. He stole from Jerry Goldsmith,
mm-hmm.
who, so this is the interesting connection. Jerry Goldsmith did a bunch of the music for Star Trek.
Yep.
James Horner did the score for also Star Trek movies. Jerry Goldsmith did the score for Patton. And in this movie, he uses the horn piece from Patton repeatedly. And every time he played, part of me died. I hate you, James Horner.
Well,
ruined my movie experience.
If I'm remembering correctly, I think this was completed posthumously for James Horner. So I don't know if he had a lot of a hand in it, considering I think he died last year. And so I don't know when this...
He's in the credits.
Yeah, he is. He is in the credits. They had a thing at the end, you know, it was an in memory of at the very end of the credits, if I'm remembering correctly for him. So I'm like, oh, I didn't know that happened. And then, you know, I looked it up afterwards. But yeah, I do know what you mean.
I salute him for his amazing work, especially the amount of work that he did.
Mm-hmm.
In his life, he was very talented, but I'm not going to celebrate his death because that would be morbid and horrible.
Yeah.
But I hopefully this is the last time I have to rant about James Horner.
I think it was really interesting seeing these two next to each other, and I'm really glad that I did. I think that... seeing, because I saw Magnificent Seven first, and then I saw Hell or High Water, and it was just such a an interesting parallel between them. Because there's the thing that I saw was that you have flawed protagonists that are fighting this like evil, which in both movies is really portrayed as just like evil, evil, evil. I mean, Peter Sarsgaard's character is just like the scum of the earth. And in the in Hell or High Water, the bad guy is not Jeff Bridges. He's an antagonist, but he's not the thing that the protagonists are fighting ever, really. The thing that the protagonists are fighting is this kind of huge passive enemy that is the banking industry, which is like screwing everyone out of their real estate, which I think they never... portrayed any of the bank people as, other than the tellers, they never portrayed any of them as sympathetic at all.
I also want to point out in Magnificent Seven, which had all these shots that didn't look like necessarily True Detective, or in Hell or High Water, they did have shots that looked like True Detective. In Magnificent Seven was written by the guy who wrote True Detective.
Right. Exactly my point. There was another parallel in there too. I think Hell or High Water obviously I think felt nicer because it was leaner. I think the problem with Magnificent Seven, and especially this is especially true today, I'm just burned out on movies where there's more than four like main characters that I have to think about and deal with. It's like I can't Marvel, stop it.
As much as I enjoy Chris Pratt, and I enjoyed him in this movie,
yeah.
As I enjoy him in all movies,
mm-hmm.
He's not Steve McQueen.
Well, I mean, I think
that is not that he's not that kind of cool.
Yeah. I think they did. They could have distanced the characters a little bit better from the prior movie versions of them, I think they tried for a few folks, and it was just never. It wasn't a good mix because it does feel that I did feel that copy of a copy feel of it. Like they could have gone back to the original Seven Samurai like feel for some of those characters, and that would have been, I think, a better like homage to it. But the direction they went was like just different enough, but still so the same that I'm like, yeah, he's supposed to be Steve McQueen, and that doesn't work. I thought Denzel Washington did a good turn as his character, though. Actually, I liked pretty much everybody in their roles. Ethan Hawke did a great job. Vincent D'Onofrio did a good job. I liked the actors, and I liked how it was shot, but there's just something about the weight of it that that never pulled me in. And I think it's just because there were too many things to focus on. There's too many things going on.
I don't want to say it's a bad movie. It's worth a watch.
Yeah.
It's not the original.
It's not the classic that the original would be. It's not like a New Age classic.
It felt very much like we're making a 2016 movie.
Yeah.
It's going to be more violent, and it's going to be, the action was great. I thought it was really well shot.
Yeah. And it is actually very violent. I didn't know it was going to be like R level violence, I guess, when I walked in. So I don't know why I assumed it would be, the same level of violence in The Magnificent Seven, the original Magnificent Seven, which is not that violent, honestly. But
which this one was PG-13, though.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Maybe they didn't swear in order to...
they didn't swear, and there was a lot of... There actually was a specific scene where a guy got shot and went, and fell over.
Mm.
Like, that's real. That happened.
Yeah. Yeah, it was it was a good movie, but I agree with you. It's certainly not a classic. I think Hell or High Water isn't necessarily a classic, but it's a movie that it is higher up.
We won't be talking about Hell or High Water in 3 years, but for this year, it's good.
Yeah,
Magnificent Seven. I would say you can skip it and just watch the original, and then watch Unforgiven, and you'll be fine.
We should do like a good a good, bad, and the ugly westerns marathon. There's so many movies that I think I really love the western genre. So I'm glad that they're still kind of exploring it. It's just a nice and interesting kind of way to do it. You can still tell your morality tale or not, and really, put a compelling story together without and make it original. I mean, even if it's a remake. Anyway, enough.
Time for us to ride off into the sunset.
Yes, yes. And it is just about sunset here at the Not a Thing podcast recording studios, and I say plural because we're in two different places, but I'll talk to you next week, Brendan.
Till next time, Alan.